Okay, today is October 22nd, and my name is Deborah Schwartz. I'm sitting here with author, naturalist, hiker, runner, historian, longtime resident of Marin County, Barry Spitz. And I'm sitting here with you, Barry, on behalf of the Mill Valley Historical Society and the Mill Valley Library. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us your story and the many stories I foresee in this conversation. Let us begin with just a little background information about you. Can you tell me a little bit about your family?
Okay, you said to go back to the grandparents, so my father's parents came from what is now Belarus. I believe Minsk was the town my father's father was born in. I never met my father's mother. I did meet the father's father. He came over probably around 1900. My father was born in Brooklyn in 1910. My mother was born in the borderlands. That's had many, many countries. I think it's part of Ukraine now. She always said she was born in Poland. Her whole family came over and around when she was about 5, 19, 18 or so. And she also came to Brooklyn, and my parents met there. They got married in 1936. They had my sister Sadell in 1941, two days after Pearl Harbor. And then I was born November 16th, 1948, 2 days after Prince Charles. We lived in my father mostly worked in the grocery business. My mother didn't work after she was married. We lived in an apartment building on 376 East 94th Street in Brooklyn, which is where I was born. Then we moved to 396 Rockaway Parkway, a few blocks away. I went to PS 219, then junior high school 252, which was right across the street from where we lived, and then Tilden High School, which was a few blocks away. I did meet my mother's mother, never met my mother's father. He died fairly early after coming over. So I knew two of the grandparents. My sister had two children, two sons, my sister Sadell, David and Craig. And she died of breast cancer when she was 40, and that was the saddest thing that's ever happened. And I'm still close to her two children, who now each of them have five children together, total. And so I try to take care of them.
Do they live nearby?
They live in New York.
And can you tell me the names of your parents?
My father was named Hyman Lewis Spitz. My mother is named Rose Spitz. Rose. The name may have been Spitalowitz, we always thought, and it got changed at Ellis Island. But I've since heard that its story is more complicated, and I don't even know it. I should, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. So you're still close to your sister's family?
Yes, we just went back, actually, for a family gathering last month. My sister was 7 years older, and She got married young. She met her husband when she was 14. They got married at 21. So we didn't have all that many years years together, but she was a wonderful person.
So you are on the opposite side of the continent now. How did you come to California?
Well, I always tell two stories. One, watching Leave It to Beaver somehow and some other shows, always, I don't even know if that was filmed in California, I assume it was. It just looked really neat compared to where we were. So that put California in my mind. We also, my mother's sister lived in Los Angeles, and we did visit her when I was very young. Seven, actually, I actually sang in Disneyland a few weeks after it opened in Frontierland. I had my Davy Crockett coonskin hat on, and it wasn't so slick as it is now, and they called me up. So that visit to California must have been on my mind. But the immediate thing that finally got me to come, I was going to Columbia University Graduate School Business, and I was driving a cab part-time, and it was a side street in the East 60s or 70s, and I was blocked, and like any good cabbie, I just leaned my elbow on the horn, and I saw this disabled guy get out, and I realized I gotta get out of here. I didn't like what was happening, and I left very soon after that. I left literally the day after I graduated. I drove out in my father's old Rambler, which did not make it. Started spewing fumes in Tennessee. I didn't know anyone, but I had former girlfriend's parents, and I never met the parents, lived in Little Rock. And on a whim, I just called them, and they said, sure, come on over. She wasn't there. The car just barely made it there, and they put me up, and I sold it to their garbage man. And I took a bus to Santa Fe, which was actually my original destination. It wasn't discovered then. I just looked in the encyclopedia. It looked really neat. So I went to Santa Fe, and with a Columbia MBA, undiscovered Santa Fe, I was a bit of a sensation there, and the bank put me in this program to become president in a few years. And but I still had California in my mind, so after a few months there, I bought a Volkswagen, and I had a friend in San Francisco, a high school friend. If he had lived in Los Angeles, I may well have gone to Los Angeles, but so I came to San Francisco.
And this is what year exactly?
1970. I was very young. I got my degrees very young. I skipped a year in, as many New Yorkers do, as a program, and then I went to college in 3 years, and I went through Columbia in 4 consecutive terms. So I was very young, too young for the Columbia part. And so I was still 21 when I came here.
Wow. So you bolted, sounded like. You kind of bolted right out of the eastern part of the U.S.
Yeah, I would go back a lot, I remember. I definitely flew back 2, 3, 4 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't abandon my family at all, and my sister came out a few times, and my parents came out a few times, so it was not, it wasn't to get away from them, it was to get away from New York, I guess, or to go to a place that sounded really special.
And so you're living in San Francisco then?
Right, I lived 5 years in San Francisco, right on Knob Hill. I had a pretty neat spot, and I had a tough time the first few months. There was a bit of an economic downturn right then. Didn't get a job for a few months. A story, I think I'm getting way off track here. I'm telling a lot of personal
stuff. It's always good to talk about the world that, as you knew it at that time, you know, for us to understand what San Francisco and the Bay Area was like.
Well, I had I didn't have much money to begin with, and so I wasn't getting a job right away, and was really down almost nothing. And I remember at the bottom of the barrel, I decided I was going to go pick grapes in the Napa Valley. And before I went up that night, I went to Berkeley to see my very favorite movie, which I'd already seen before, Elvira Madigan. Still my favorite movie. And I said, I can't pay, and they let me in for free, which I still have a good feeling about Berkeley. And I drove up there, and I slept in my car, and I was going to go apply for picking jobs in the morning, and I just didn't do it. I came back and ended up working temporary, and then I began my short corporate career using my MBA degree.
In San Francisco?
Yeah.
Who did you work with?
My first job was with a division of, it was called Cal Inc. It was the largest ink manufacturer in California. It was bought up by Tenneco Chemicals, so it was a division of this giant conglomerate. And I did meet someone there who that remains the most very emotional attachment with this older woman, and who worked there too. And she was of Irish descent, and suddenly I got in my mind that I was going to go to Ireland. So after a year and a half or so, I did go to Ireland with the idea of living there for a year and writing a novel. And that did not work out, because she was still on my mind very much, and she came to Paris. So I totally blew my budget and met her in Paris, and just didn't have the money to continue. So I came back and got another job with Dutch Boy Paints. And then I got a really good job, the highest I went in the corporate world. I was the manager of the Treasury Department of the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco, which regulated and lent money to the savings and loans, which were way bigger in the 70s. You don't hear much about them now, but they were big then. And I signed checks for literally $1 billion, when $1 billion meant something, and moved a lot of money around. I was very responsible, and had a lot of trips to New York, the private dining rooms of the big banks there. And the big good that came out of it is I was able to buy, I'd always looked over and seen that it was sunny in Marin while it was foggy in San Francisco, so I had this idea of moving to Marin. So with this job, I was able to buy a house in San Anselmo. It was a hot market at that time too. You had to make up your mind within an hour or two, and I saw this house, 155 Los Angeles Boulevard, San Anselmo, and looked nice. I only had to put $5,600 down, 10%, and I have lived there 40 years now, and no regrets about it. It's been a wonderful house, and it's enabled pretty much a lot of what happened after to happen.
I have to say that in listening to you talk about your corporate life, it's very hard to visualize you as a suit sitting before me in
mm-hmm.
your cargo hiking pants
mm-hmm.
and your outdoor clothing, very much the picture of the outdoor man. It's very hard to imagine you being anything else. So what's the transition from corporate suit to author and runner, and how did this all, and your books? Let's
right.
talk about your books.
Right. Well, it was a different world. I drank, not to excess, but as one normally does in those things. And I have a picture of myself weighing about 190. I weigh about 150 now, which is a little less than I would like, but it was different. But I was realizing I was not. What was happening is I started to get involved with running and nature. Two things happened. I met a lady named Marie Mans while I was on the Dutch boy paint job. This was around 1973, 72 or 3. And she is the most remarkable naturalist I have ever met. There's no one like her. She's deceased now, but she was an older German lady. I had just bought a pair of binoculars and a bird book and was just beginning birding. Didn't I was out at Bolinas Lagoon with it on a date and looking at a great blue heron, but not knowing it was a great blue heron. I was just a beginner. And this lady comes to a screeching halt in her German accent. Says, "Have you spotted the yellow-billed loon?" Which was the second sighting in the history of California. It was known to be out there at Bolinas Lagoon. I didn't know what she was talking about, but we became friends. And we became very good friends. She was many years older, and she took me on her Christmas bird counts, where she set national records for Hutton's Vireos a couple of years in a row. And she was a pioneer in bird song, either the first or worked with the first people who understood that white-crowned sparrows have dialects based on where they come from. And there was no one with an ear like her, and no one could tell the weather like her. And she would bird without binoculars. So she got me into nature, and I had with her the most remarkable natural experience I've ever had. We were sitting at Limantour Beach. This was in the mid-70s, birding, and it was a crit. We were breaking for lunch. We were sitting on the bluff by the parking lot, looking out over the lagoon. Crystal clear day, and all of a sudden there was thunder. That was our reaction, and we didn't know what it was. And then we realized a peregrine falcon had swooped within feet of us. It created thunder, and it was going down for the thousands, tens of thousands of Dunlin down there. And so two remarkable things: one, that it passed within a few feet of our head at near 200 miles an hour, and that it didn't get any of the Dunlin. They did their amazing flights, and he didn't get any of them. So we shared many. She took me to Yosemite many times, the Sierra, other parts of the Sierra. She would camp out all over the place, and I owe a lot of what follows to her. I happened, she moved to Oregon, and a couple of years ago, only two years ago, we stayed in touch. She got a brain tumor. She was probably 93 or so, and she took the Oregon assisted suicide. And we drove up. We were going to go anyhow. And I think she waited for us. Me and my wife and my daughter was there, one of the daughters. And I think she waited. I got to see her literally the day before she took her life. So she had a huge influence on what happened. The other thing that was happening, and it may have been related, I started running. And I got really into running. The running boom was taking off. This was 1973. And I have a log now. I have every run recorded since 1975, I think. Every day's run. And I really got into the running world. It just became my passion. And I realized that was that the outdoors and running were my passions. And that's what I would talk to people about, and not about my home loan bank job. And so I thought, well, maybe I should follow my passion. So I quit. I tried one more job with Wells Fargo Bank. And I met a lady who, met a good friend there, but we, you know, we both couldn't handle the place. They were smoking. I remember that. They allowed smoking in those days, and the guy next to me and my little, that contributed, but I just could not stand it there. And me and my, this friend, I started writing a book about running. I was involved with City Sports magazine somehow, and they were going to publish a book about where to run, or I started it before I met them, I don't remember. So I started writing this book about where to run, which, you know, running was a boom. You couldn't miss book. And they published it.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Best Running Trails of the San Francisco Bay Area. Unfortunately, another book of virtually the same title came out like 2 weeks earlier. So we split the market. But so I quit Wells Fargo after maybe 3 or 4 months. And went to manage a running store.
Which store?
It was in the brand new Larkspur Landing. It just opened. We were original tenants. What's now called Marin Country Mart. And I crazily stayed there 8 years. I mean, it was an easy job, but that was ridiculous to stay 8 years, but I did.
Ridiculous because?
Well, it was, that was too long for that particular job.
Mm-hmm.
But during that time I began writing. I felt that, you know, I was running on Mount Tam a lot. My peak year I ran 2,500 miles. And we would run, me and my buddies would run almost every day, long runs on Mount Tam. And I remember when David Carpenter was active.
Mm-hmm.
First we didn't worry because he only killed women and then he killed a man, and we were worried, but we were figuring, wow, what the heck, two of us. And I remember one day there was no one there. It was me and him running, and whenever
Where were you running?
It was on the east side of the mountain above Corte Madera, high up.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we would see somebody way away and get spooky.
Mm-hmm.
And happily they caught him very soon after. But I joined the Tamalpa Runners in 1978, one of the earliest members. And I was just totally into the running world. I got very involved with announcing races. Through City Sports, they were the co-sponsors of a race, co-founders of a race called Bridge to Bridge, which is still on and draws many, many thousands. And that was the first race I ever announced as the finish line announcers. And that led, somehow people liked me, and that led to a career as a race announcer. While I still had the good sport job. But I got to announce Beta Breakers, San Francisco Marathon. I announced the first ever Women's World Road Championship, an IAAF event, which is really big time. I announced the Avon Marathon in Paris, even though I didn't speak French. I announced the women's marathon they held on the 1984 Olympic course as a test run. It was a full marathon where the American record was set in the marathon, women's record. And this continued even after I got married. This went on for years, and we got to go to, you know, Hawaii a couple of times. And
the Ironman?
No, the Honolulu Marathon. Mm-hmm. I was writing for Running Times, first Runner's World magazine I wrote for, and then Running Times lasted many years. I was their race reporter, so I would get trips all over.
Nice.
Four wonderful trips, staying in incredible hotels. And as I said, even after I got married, I brought my wife, and we had family vacations. So I was very associated with running. But not the Dipsy yet. That took a while, and we'll get to that.
Mm-hmm.
So, finally, I guess I'm rambling a little bit, but while I was at the Good Sport, I was on Mount Tam a lot, running mostly. And I thought there should be a guidebook to the trails. I kind of knew them well, and there wasn't the guidebook. So I said, I'm going to do that. And while I was kind of dawdling about it, thinking about it, maybe even researching it, one came out, written by people who live two blocks from me, the Martins, a book called Mount Tamalpais. And no offense intended, but I didn't think that was the
right
book.
It's the thin book?
It was called Mount Tamalpais.
Yeah.
They've since written another one called The Hiking Marin.
Mm-hmm.
But this was their first one. And I thought, well, we could do better. And so it was the earliest days of when self-publishing was possible. They'd just come out with some programs. People, I mean, not everyone even had a computer. And a guy named Mike Hoy, who lived in Sausalito, agreed to learn while he was doing it. And he took my text, and it was a laborious project because he was learning while I was doing it,
mm-hmm.
but turned it into a camera-ready manuscript. And Dewey Livingston, who was an old dear friend, drew the maps. And Tamalpais Trails came out in 1989. There was a glitch. I got sued by a Mill Valley lady to keep a trail out that was near her house. I'd just gotten married, and we had this letter from a lawyer come. It was very unsettling, but we reached an agreement. I took the trail out. She gave me some compensation for the...
What trail was it?
I can't
say. Can't
say,
okay.
And I've kept my end of it, and she compensated me for having to redo some things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fair ending, and it took off. The response to that was incredible. I remember going to the depot in Mill Valley, the bookstore, and I think they took three or four or five, and then they called me back and they wanted 25, I think, and then they wanted 100, and then they wanted 200 for that little store.
Mm-hmm.
And all my books have had a very good relation with the depot, and I would be very, very surprised if any author, including the most famous ones, have had more sales of their books than I did.
Well, you have a wonderful advertisement for your books right outside with beautiful Mount Tam,
right.
Just taunting and inviting, and come hike, come run.
Right.
Yes. Well,
so then I quit the good sport and became a full-time writer, race announcer, and so that takes us to about 1989. And,
okay, and all the while, may I ask you about the did you do the foot research for the, you know, you yourself hiked every trail?
I hiked every trail with a wheel. And that got to be very interesting. I started enjoying the wheel, measuring wheel, measures every foot, it clicks every foot. And then I started not liking the wheel so much. And it was hard work because you do most of the trails and then you have to pick up one more and measure it. So you're carrying it a long way just to measure one trail, and you have to...
So how many trails are in the book? I mean,
there were 160, I think, in the first one.
160, yes.
And it's had six editions. Some go in and some go out, depending on... I followed earlier maps. The wonderful Olmsted Brothers map had just come out. Jerry Olmsted was a great guy. He'd just come out with the best map in a long while. And I kind of followed his work, and Dewey Livingston did the maps, as I said,
mm-hmm.
my map, but we kind of followed that. So it's not all the trails were authorized. I did historic trails that have appeared on maps in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, I've wean them out, and this new edition that's about to come out, published by the Golden Gate Conservancy, which may have a new name, Mount Tamalpais Trails, will only be officially designated trails.
Mm-hmm.
But so there were 160 originally, probably 190 or so have appeared in and out over the various editions. But yes, I did all the work. Everyone was visited several times, looking at the flowers over different seasons, with all the intersections and the distances. And,
mm-hmm.
And it was called the Via magazine, the AAA magazine, called it the Bible of the Mountain. And Sunset gave it a very high praise, and Tom Steenstra wrote good things about it. It was, and I'm very proud of it. The definitive work, I think, on the trails of Mount Tam, and I don't think anybody else has tried to venture there.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some new maps that have been excellent using the GPS, and I'm very proud of that. And, so that was my first book, and since we sold it ourselves, published it ourselves, sold it, it was printed in Michigan. It was a pretty good additional source of income. As I said, I got married in 1989 to Pamela Spitz, Pamela Neal, and we had Sally in 1990 and Lily in 1992, so we did need to. So she wasn't working in the early years, but she did go back to her to being a teacher soon after. So this became our primary source of income, publishing.
I guess you put that suit right back in the closet, hmm?
Right. I do not own a suit now. We just went back for a big event, and I bought a really nice blazer at Barney's, has an outlet store in Napa, really sharp. So that served me, but I do not own a suit. Not proud of that. I just don't. So it's very, go on.
You went on to write other books as well. That
right.
Did that started you on another trend.
Right.
Then.
So the next one, you know, this looked like a good business model to use the current lingo.
Get to do what you want to do and research what you like. And.
Right. So I had gotten, the Dipsy, of course, is the race of Marin, Mill Valley, Marin, the Bay Area, maybe along with the Bay Breakers, but I had not been that involved with it. I don't know why. I've been trying to figure that out, because I got involved in running in 73 or 4, as I said. I ran my first race in 74. But I don't know why it took me so long to get involved with the Dipsy. But in 1981, a guy named Keith Hastings, a Marin figure, guy asked me to help him bring water to. There was no official water station yet at Cardiac like they have now, the highest point. And he had a friend running. So I helped him take water from the Lone Tree Fountain, which was working then. And I saw the race. And
all this running, and you'd never thought to join the Dipsy race?
I'm sure I saw it or reported on it, but I don't have any memories of it.
Uh-huh.
Until that's my first vivid memory. I might even have run some practice. I don't know. But that's my vivid memory. And his friend Florian Harp had this huge lead and went on to win the race. And the next year, I was asked to announce the race, because I already had a reputation as a race announcer and in the running world. Was known, and the announcer died, a guy named James Farron. He was a young man, and they've named the stretch from Cardiac to Lone Tree Farron's Rest, because they scattered his ashes there. He died of cancer. So I was now the announcer of the Dipsy, and there had been a book written about the Dipsy called The Dipsy Race by a guy named Mark Reese. It came out in 1978. So, wait, I'm getting my years wrong. All right. So I had been involved with the Dipsy. I became the announcer. I founded the dinner they had. The first dinner was held at the Mill Valley Community Church,
mm-hmm.
right near Old Mill Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved it to the Dipsy Cafe. And then I turned it over to the Dipsy Committee. But I also founded the Dipsy Hall of Fame in 1993 and named the first five inductees. And I finally got in 2015, which I thought was a little long of a wait. But
did we'll you announce it?
So I was very involved. So this fellow, Mark Rees, had written a book in 1978. So in 1990, early 90s, I had started to think maybe it was time to update that. And what finally got me going on that was the death of Paul Scirone, who happened to live in San Anselmo. He won the race in 1937, but I never talked to him. I planned to, and he died, and I went to his funeral, and I said, I gotta, before these more of these pass away, I want to do this. And Mark Rees was terrific. He's a lawyer, so he kept meticulous files. He gave me all his files, no questions asked, no restrictions. Made my life way easier. He had clippings from every single newspaper clippings of every year. Made the work so much easier. And I went and interviewed every living Dipsy winner, which was a joy to do that. And widows of others. And my second book, Dipsy, The Greatest Race, came out in 1993. Again, it was a huge success. Sold out in no time. And I got to meet some wonderful, wonderful people. The two of the most famous being Jack Kirk, who was the Dipsy Demon. He ran his first Dipsy in 1930 and never missed another one.
The guy who ran in the house slippers later on?
He ran in little sneakers and in his pants. And he was a real character. He owned 400 acres in Mariposa. I got to interview him in 1992. His mind was as sharp as can be, even though he was he died at 100. He was pushing 90 then, or 90. And I remember we went up with Sally and my wife. Sally was like 2. And to his 400 acre, which was completely wild. He lived in a Volkswagen with no buildings.
He lived in his car?
He lived in his car, and he loved it. He loved flowers. He kept it wild. It
mm-hmm.
was a real sanctuary. And I wanted to talk to him about, his memory was sharp. I wanted to talk about the old Dipsies. He would remember every race and who passed and who he passed and every little quirk.
Really? Wow.
But all he wanted to do was show 2-year-old Sally the wildflower. So it was a real little frustrating. But we became friends. And then the other one was Norman Bright. He was one of the nation's best runners in the 30s. He went to Stanford. He beat Glenn Cunningham, who was considered America's greatest miler of the year a couple of times. He went blind. I met him when he was blind. I went to visit him. He was living in a home in Seattle, and to research the book. And I didn't know how he would greet me. I went in and he just embraced me. All his trophies had been stolen because he's blind. But we became very good friends. He called me all the time. And the Tamalpa runners brought him out, one of the most beautiful things, to one of the dinners. And he was an old man, and they walked him over the trail. He was blind and he was old. And
they walked him over the whole Dipsy?
It took like 6 hours. Russ Kieran, a saint, a Mill Valley guy.
I see his name on the Dipsy stairs.
Right, he's the same. I did not walk with him, but others did.
Mm-hmm.
It took 6 hours. Anyhow, we became good friends. And there's the little wrinkle to the Norman Bright story just came out. He was in the same 1936 Olympic trials 5,000 meter race as Louis Zamperini, the star of the book and movie Unbroken, which is
mm-hmm.
a big hit now. And apparently Norman helped Louis. And Norman is in the book, Unbroken, in the index and in the book. Louis made the team. Norman did not. He had blisters and did not make the team. He should have, but he didn't. His Norman Bright's sister, 94 years old, called me when the movie Unbroken was going to come out and said, can you do me this favor of trying to get me to go to the premiere? So I didn't have any Hollywood contacts, but I called Angelina Jolie's agent and I called United Artists. I forget the studio, I think that was it, that put it out. And I didn't get her in. And it showed me that, I mean, they should have. She just wanted to see that they got Norman Bright's red hair right. Turns out he wasn't in the movie at all, so didn't no harm done. But I met some wonderful, wonderful people who became good friends. I could go on the whole 2 hours of our interview talking about the wonderful old Dipsy characters that I met and stay in touch. And I put on a reunion every 5 years of the winners. We just had one. And Donna Andrews, who was the first adult woman to win in 1980, lived in Stinson Beach, came to the one in 2015 and died 10 days later.
Wow.
But she wanted to be there.
But you yourself have had quite a career with the Dipsy, haven't you?
I've now been the announcer 34 consecutive years. I'm the official race historian. Dipsy's had a second edition in for the 100th running in 2010, we call it the Centennial Edition. As I say, I founded the dinner in the Hall of Fame, and now I'm in the Hall
of
Fame.
Have you run it? How many times?
I've never run it, the race. I'm a very good uphill runner. You know, we can talk about the mountain hill climb and other things I've done, but I'm a very terrible downhill runner, and the Dipsy really does have very, very hairy downhill, and it even favors the people that are fearless on the downhill. So I've had no particular desire to race the Dipsy. They do have what's called the practice Dipsy, the double Dipsy, and the quadruple Dipsy. And I have run all of those. I've run 3 quadruple Dipsies, which is 4 crossings. Those are the longest races I've ever done by far. I once broke 61 minutes in the practice Dipsy. They don't have that anymore, but it's a regular Dipsy. And I've done maybe 10 double Dipsies, so, and I've run the course a million times, but
mm-hmm.
I've never run the race. People always ask me that, but I've never run the race. Never, I don't think I want to,
mm-hmm.
even though I'm getting a lot of minutes now. I don't, I'm happy doing what I do. I give out the award, I announce the finishers, and then I give out the awards, and that award ceremony is definitely the highlight of the year for me and for and a lot of other people. We give out these 35 black shirts, and it's really, really special. And I see the amount of injuries. I'm right on the finish line. The amount of injuries in the Dipsy is not well known. Everybody knows it's dangerous, but the amount of injuries is staggering. There's no other race like it. Nothing. Among popular events, I sometimes think maybe a quarter of the people have had some kind of trauma, fallen or bleeding. You clearly see the dirt on them. I mean, and when it's hot, it's carnage. They've run out of ambulances. I remember not too many years ago,
from
people passing. They just didn't have enough ambulance. They had to bring in helicopters. It is a very, very dangerous race. Because it's on a very narrow trail, and very steep and narrow trail with rocks and roots, but added to that is the handicaps, where the faster runners, the younger runners, start after the older runners. So in every other normal race, the young, fast guys are in front, and there's very little passing. But the Dipsy, passing all the time, and including going down steep ravine, which is dangerous to walk down,
yeah.
Much less having somebody flying by you trying to pass you. So there's a lot of injuries in that race. Mm-hmm. But that's what makes it a great race.
So we've got the book on the running. We've got the book on the Dipsy.
Right. Then we come to Mill Valley.
Our beautiful Mill Valley.
Right. So I'm on a roll here. I've written two successful books. And there was a great guy. He was the president of the Mill Valley Historical Society named Ron Olson. He was a really great man, a wise man. The Dipsy had a similar wise man who a park in Mill Valley is named after Hauke Park, Jerry Hauke. They were kind of similar. They even looked similar.
I had no
idea
there was an association between the Dipsy and Hauke Park.
Yes, he was the race director for 33 years. Ron Olson and Jerry Hauke, kind of the same age and kind of looked like one of the wise old men with beards and white hair that you just trust, and they're good people. They have no agendas, just they want to do the right thing. And I happen to be friends with Ron Olson through hiking. I was on the board of the Tamalpais Conservation Club in the 70s, or it may have been early 80s, time of turmoil, which that organization now has nothing but turmoil. And I got to know Ron Olson, he was on the board, and I got to ride to meetings. The meetings used to be in San Francisco, their headquarters, with Salem Rice, who's the great geologist of Mount Tamalpais. So those were good guys. So Ron Olson suggested that maybe I should write a history of Mill Valley. There had not been one. And he was the president, as I said, of the Historical Society. And I got to meet...
I'm going to just pause this for a minute while I shut the door. Very sorry to interrupt. A little pause. You're talking about Ron Olson here. You got...
Right. He led me into the Mill Valley Historical Society, and they were magnificent. I am not saying this, you guys, because you're doing the interview. I was treated so well. Any help I would need was offered to me, research-wise, and Joyce Cruz. I spent a lot of time with her in that history room. People like, most of them deceased now. I remember meeting Dory Bassett. She was incredible. I'm forgetting Jack and Jean Barnard.
That was the Ralston White's niece, right. And Ralston and Ruth White's niece.
Larry,
yes.
Sims. He made his files available. I'm Stocking. Jean Stocking was amazing. Her family goes way back to before it was Mill Valley. I think all these people are deceased now, but they were incredibly helpful.
And what year are we now?
So I began work in 96 or 95. The book came out. I have my prefaces written October 96. And then it had a publication date of 97, because you always kind of want to make it look more recent.
Mm-hmm.
So this work was done in 95 and 96. And They were just terrific, and we called it Mill Valley, the early years. I only focused up until around 1930. That mm-hmm. was a decision we kind of made together, because more recent, number one, it filled the book, made a large book.
What you
book.
Had was enough to fill
right,
the book.
Right, it filled
yes.
a large book already. That's
mm-hmm.
one reason. But the other is, the more recent stuff is a lot... Mill Valley, I don't have to tell you, a lot of controversies. It wouldn't have been so clear what it would have. It just would have been a different book.
More people alive to argue with the facts.
Right. So I kept... I don't know whether I intended to follow it up. People asked me to. Since then, there have been a few other books, small books, though, more picture books, taking it up more recently. But it's probably should be updated. Because it's going to be almost 100 years from what I covered from 1930 on. But this book sold out. Dewey Livingston again helped me with design, a beautiful cover he did.
Mm-hmm. the cover of
Mill Valley, the early years.
There you have, but what is the picture?
The old mill with
the old
two
mill.
Children sitting on it.
Uh-huh.
And that, this book sold out. I had to reprint it several times quickly.
How many do you think you've sold? Just guessing.
It's had 5 printings. Over 10,000, but I'm not somewhere in that.
What's the population of Mill Valley?
Right, that's
yes.
More than one per home.
Yes.
More than one per home,
mm-hmm.
due to some, you know, turnover. But that is a pretty high per capita sales. So Mill Valley, you know, I wanted to move to Mill Valley. I've fallen in love with the place while doing this research, which was so much fun. I would eat at Stefano's or, now I forget the name. It's at right next to the movie theater. You used to be able to sit and look out on the
street.
Oh,
you mean the bakery that was there? Or before that?
Before that.
Oh, the Noah's Bagel?
No. Way before that.
Oh, the Sinapa Farms?
Sinapa Farms,
yes.
And so I would research for hours and then go take a break. And it was sweet. It was just really wonderful. And we just didn't find a place that was affordable. And so I remained in San Anselmo.
You can't get a house for, how much did you say you put down?
8,000?
5,000? Yes, no, that's...
No, that won't do it. That won't pay the... It won't pay very much.
But
so,
you, how long did it take you to write this book?
I don't really remember, but certainly a year in that range, maybe a little more. But the Mill Valley has its act together. That history room, you didn't need to go far afield. I mean, they had all the Mill Valley records, all the newspapers. I mean, it was just... I was able to research that job efficiently.
Mm-hmm. You aren't the only author to tell me so. And I'm not just saying this because I'm in the Historical Society.
Fabulous.
But other authors, Tom Killian, Gary Snyder, all these, many people have utilized, Matthew Davis, have utilized the History Room as a resource to write their books. It's a treasure for him, Mill Valley.
Right, I had used it already for the Dipsy book too, but I really got to almost live there. And I said Joyce Cruz was a tough taskmaster, but she did the right thing. Because I've been to other history rooms where they let you take stuff out, doesn't come back. She followed the rules, the correct rules, and it made it a little harder not to take things home, but that was correct.
Preserved
right.
The material, and you ended up spending a lot more time in the
right.
town you were writing about.
Right, exactly. You got it right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the third book, and I've been a member of the Mill Valley History Society, Historical Society, for a long time now.
I hope we'll see you at the dinner tonight.
We'll talk about that.
Okay, well, so we've got this. By the way, I've used this book as a resource in my own business. It's the definitive book for me in providing a really good overview of the history of Mill Valley. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yes. So, and then, but yet, you're not done.
No.
Yet we have more books. There's more to tell.
Right, there's still 4 more books.
Yes.
So, given my outdoors resume and my book resume, I was asked to write or propose, I don't remember, but in any case was asked, to write a guidebook to the Marin County Open Space District Preserves. At the time, they had 33, about 14,000 acres. I knew Ron, got to know Ron Miska. I knew Brian Sanford, one of the rangers, and that was another wonderful project because it got me, they have some preserves on Mount Tam, But they also have preserves elsewhere, and I
Ring Mountain.
Ring
There's
Mountain. Several in Nevada, Mount
Nevada,
Bedell.
right?
So I got really. Indian Tree is this amazing one in Nevada that I never would have discovered. Roy's Redwoods. And so I got to go to places that I didn't visit regularly in my runs. The wheel again. And again, it was about 150 trails or so, all measured to the foot. I did buy a GPS watch, but it's just not as accurate. Maybe it is today, but it would go out a little bit in the deep woods. And
yes.
I just felt that most accurate. And also, you can do the intersections really to the feet.
Mm-hmm.
I still think that's the way to do it. I mean, to wheel the Tamalpa Trail, I remember, was...
Can't
you know,
imagine.
I don't know how accurate that is, bumping along like that, but there are some downsides to it. But I again wheeled all the trails, visited. They were very helpful, the rangers, and we came out with a wonderful book in 2000 called Open Spaces, Lands of the Marin County Open Space District. I was the distributor for that too. They published it. This was the first book that somebody else published.
And they?
The Marin County Open Space
mm-hmm.
District. It's now called Marin County Parks.
Mm-hmm.
And, but they didn't want to get involved with selling it. So I was the distributor for that book as well. And that sold out very quickly. And, they wanted to do another edition, and I was going to do it with David Herlocker. I told you Marie Manns was the greatest naturalist I've ever met. David Herlocker would stand second, and certainly unsurpassed than Marin. Great man, still with them. He's their naturalist, leads hikes, go on them. He leads hikes almost every week for them. Anyhow, we worked together, and he added immensely with he wrote about, you know, the spiders and the natural history, and I updated everything, and that book sat. I don't know why. It's 9 years now it's been sitting in the office. They've had some different general managers. Then they decided to do whole new trails plan that ended any chance of it coming out, but that book never came out. I got paid, but it's a shame, because that book, there has been no, it's been out of print now for 12 years or so,
mm-hmm.
and people want a guidebook to the open space preserves,
mm-hmm.
but there is none.
Hmm.
So that's a sad story, and I still don't know the whole story behind it, because it was a good book. Better than the first one. So then we come to my town, San Anselmo, where I lived 4 years. I did Mill Valley, so I thought, what the heck, do San Anselmo. And that is where I learned to appreciate how great the Mill Valley resources was, because San Anselmo does not have anything like it. They have a history room. The collection is has some nice stuff, but nowhere near as large or as complete or as curated. A lady named Judy Coy has since done wonderful work. She was kind of involved then a little bit, but has since gone on to be very involved, and it's a lot better, but it was way more difficult. They had a lot of San Anselmo heralds, but they didn't have all of them. And so it was a complete, it was a, that was a book that went up to the present. I did do a different approach for that book. And I did feel very comfortable, because I lived there for so many years. I did feel on good grounds there. And so I thought that was a very good book. And that San Anselmo Pictorial History came out in 2003. And is now out of print. They've come up with one of these little Arcadia editions, and I am very down on this Arcadia thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have their place for these extremely obscure, small topics, and they do a good job on things that are 50 pages or it's 100 pages of pictures is all that really is known about these.
Mm-hmm.
But not for, all history shouldn't look exact, all history books shouldn't look exactly the same, have the exact same format, and just be mostly pictures. But Judy Coy wrote one about San Anselmo, and she's done a good job. So I'm asked to do more on that, to do an updated version, but I don't think there's, I don't think I will.
Mm-hmm. Then what happened? What's the next book?
Then, well, why aim small? I did Marin, a history. This is the last complete history of Marin. It had been done in 1880, and it's a treasure. And nothing quite like it. And by Monroe, a guy named Monroe Fraser. Just this totally amazing book that literally describes everything that's ever happened in Marin, because not that much.
Mm-hmm.
It happened until 1880. And that was the last complete history, so it certainly seemed time. So how to structure that book became very interesting, because the topic is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up splitting. I was going to write it with my friend Dewey Livingston, who knows Marin history better than anyone and has so many other talents in designing a book. And but he wanted to write it in a different way, and so I ended up doing it on my own, and took the approach of the days that changed Marin. I think there were 100, and I forget how many. And it
he
made
chose
it easier
to just select a particular
the landmark
that
days that
mm-hmm.
that ended up changing the future of Marin. And I think it's very, I like that approach. It was a little easier to write than some other ways of doing it. And other people have enjoyed that. It's a little different than approach. Maybe the right one, maybe not. But that too has sold out completely. And beautiful cover. I worked with Laurie Thompson at the Ann Kent California Room,
mm-hmm.
and they have, whatever I could say about Mill Valley, I would say the same about that collection, and even bigger, more, they have more room and more topics, and Laurie Thompson is another master archivist, librarian. She gave me her full support with pictures and materials, and we're good friends, and I had her full cooperation in that book, and they were, actually was a benefit for the library. I got a, this is little known here, this is one of your scoops here, I got people criticize the supervisors, they call it a slush fund, or that's the negative term, but they use another discretionary fund.
Mm-hmm.
I got an advance to publish the book from that discretionary fund, but with the proviso that all the, it would be repaid and all the money would go to the Ann Kent California Room. So it became a benefit for the Ann Kent California Room,
mm-hmm.
and that made me feel good about it. And then there's one last one. I did subsequently, as I say, in 2010, write another version of the Dipsy book, but then the Frank Howard Allen company, realty company, was celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2010, and they asked me to write a history of their company.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Howard Allen was a pretty neat guy, and nothing had been written about him as far as I know, and they published it and they controlled it, and it's not sold anywhere. They gave it to their employees, and the company has since been consumed. But one legacy I have of that book, Frank Howard Allen designed, well, now that's the name of the subdivision is slipping my mind, but it's on Laurel Grove. It's the Kent Field side of Laurel Grove.
Mm-hmm.
And to I believe that is the most beautiful street in Marin County, and it he did that. He made that subdivision, and it's a testament to what could be, what should be, what's right, because that is the best, just the best Marin has to offer. I mean, the Ross side, of course, is splendid, but that's due to huge, huge parcels. But his side was a subdivision, but you'd never know it. It's so beautiful and peaceful and restful, and I take it as an alternate to Drake because it calms me down, and that's a good sign. So those are the books.
But what about the Conservation Club book? Did you mention that? Tell me
Oh
the new
my
book.
God, I left that out. Thank you, thank you. That is the
I
last
just
book.
bought that book from
Right,
you.
and I didn't even put it on my list yet. That's the one in many ways is my, and that I'm proudest. It's kind of my swan song that I embraced. It's called, we had a few different little stories about what to call it, and we ended up calling it.
For all those that can't see this, I'm watching you go through a bag
I'm
filled with your
pulling out.
books and trying to find that book too. Let's see, isn't this it here? No, that's the open space.
I guess it
Oh,
fell
hey,
out.
here it is. Isn't this it?
No.
Oh,
That's the.
well, I can go run and grab it really quick. Hang on a second. Well, let me just pause this for a moment.
Don't know what happened.
Okay, now I've got your book for you. There you
To
go.
Save a Mountain, the 100-Year Battle for Mount Tamalpais. This was another 100-year project. As I said, I had been on the board. I'm a life member of the Tamalpais Conservation Club. And they were having their 100th anniversary in 2012. And Larry Minicus and Janice Barry were president and vice president and wanted me to write. I probably approached them, and they thought it was a great idea to write not just a history of the club, which was founded before there was any public land on Mount Tamalpais. So it became an intertwined story of the club, but more, far more, how Mount Tamalpais went from 100% private property in 1912, well, in 1905 was the first public land acquisition, to almost entirely public land. And I'm really proud of this book. It's very little known because the Tamalpais Conservation Club published it, and they are in hard times right now with a very not much of active members in order to get the word out. But if you want to know how who these heroes are, and you always start with William Kent, as I do, who not only donated the very first public land, which is now Muir Woods, which they wanted a name for him, but he didn't, he refused it. He was the number one force behind the Marin Municipal Water District election in 1912, even though he had the most to lose by this. He was going to get, he was the largest landowner by far, and most of the land that the water district was going to get was his land. He was going to get paid for it, but not what he should have been, and he refused that anyhow, and he advocated, because it was in the public good, to have a water source and recreational use. So he was the leader in that, and that was a very contested election, but he swayed it, and we voted for it. It was the very first municipal water district in California, but they had no money originally. They just were given the right to buy this land, private land. He then led the what's called the biggest thing ever to happen in Marin, and the Marin paper wrote a bond issue in 1916. Again, against his interest, still advocated that we pass this huge bond issue. This was more, far more controversial than the original one, because there was money involved, and we passed it, and that created, that gave the water district the money to purchase the land and build Alpine Dam, the big project that was going to solve our water problems forever.
And the water gouging, because now we have a public agency. And
you said that, not me.
And the ability for people to use the mountain recreationally.
Right.
And hunting, too, as I believe.
Right. William Kent, that was the origin of the Tamalpais Conservation Club. The myth says, probably true, though, but it has become mythical, that they some people, O'Rourke and a few others, famous names in Mount Tam, saw a deer being quartered on William Kent land at Rock Spring, and it just revulsed them, and they wanted to stop hunting on Mount Tam, and they did succeed in creating a Mount Tamalpais wildlife preserve even before the state park, or that was in 1916. But Kent also was the force behind the state park, and that's where the Tamalpais Conservation Club had its greatest impact. They were the leaders in that monumental battle to create Mount Tamalpais State Park, and that's the heart of the book. And I feel my big contribution is understanding the relation of the state park and panoramic highway, which I don't think had been forgotten in more recent years. Overwhelmingly, the voters of Marin approved a bond measure in the early 20s when cars were just the rage to connect Mill Valley and Stinson Beach more directly. Residents of Stinson Beach and Bolinas, the kids went to Tam, but it took them hours to go on Highway 1, and some days they couldn't even get through, the road was blocked. So they wanted a more direct route. But other people wanted a park to connect the Water District lands and Muir Woods. And this road was going to run right through that.
Mm-hmm.
It was privately owned. Kent owned a lot of it, but some other guys owned Newlands and McGee were their names, were planning on developing their nearly 1,000 acres. And it was a huge battle royale to, because you build a road, as you know, then homes usually follow alongside
mm-hmm.
it. Real estate prices go way up. The chance for buying that land would diminish. And so this was the number one environmental battle, I believe, in the history of Marin. Went on in the 20s over Panoramic Highway. Kent absolutely in the middle of it, because most of the road went through his land, and he very much wanted a state park. And in the end, a compromise was reached. They would build the road, but they would condemn all the land Kent donated his, to condemn the Newlands McGee land, and we had Mount Tamalpais State Park was created. And the day before he died, William Kent donated the initial acreage, his beloved steep ravine. And when he died, the county went in mourning. So this book is dedicated to him, and I have wanted to write a biography of William Kent. He wrote his own autobiography, but he's a modest guy and didn't take all the credit that he could have taken credit for.
He had a political career.
Right. He was our congressman for 3 terms. He had that famous falling out with John Muir, and the story that has, I've seen a video of it. It's this is the highest drama. This should be a movie. It could be a movie. You know,
he admired John Muir.
Right,
he was inspired by John Muir.
Absolutely. And President Roosevelt wanted to name Muir Woods for Kent, who donated. It was the first national monument donated by a private landowner. Very historic stuff. Now you see a little more of it, but he was a total pioneer in donating land to the government. But he said, no, name it for Muir, my hero, and the pictures of them together camping. But the Kent was in Congress, and he represented San Francisco all the way to the Oregon border, very sparsely populated. And after the earthquake, San Francisco clearly needed a reliable source of water
mm-hmm.
after the earthquake and fire.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of sympathy for San Francisco to get a water source, and they looked at the Hetch Hetchy Valley in Yosemite, which was a national park. And that was quite a battle.
So we know that also that initially they were looking at Muir Woods, which was the big rush for
right.
Kent to get this land, you know, preserved. And so without, thank goodness, which is why we have Muir Woods,
right.
There were
even after he bought it.
They were.
And donated it, it was under threat because they could have. A reservoir is a higher,
eminent domain.
Right. It's
yeah.
a higher use of it. And
so
he had to get it into the federal government hands.
It had to be very quickly transferred
right.
into the federal government, which succeeded, thank goodness. And then, of course, John Muir, with his great love of the Sierra Nevadas and the Hetch Hetchy area, is now seeing his beautiful land on threat. So what was the stance that William Kent... What was the division? Was William Kent involved in somehow in the acquisition of the Hetch Hetchy as a water source?
Kent did come down in favor of damming Hetch Hetchy.
There's the divide between the two.
He was torn.
Yes.
And I am maybe even presuming some things, but he was very, being the congressman from locally very influential, and he would serve on the interior some of the committees that were involved with this, but I really don't know his inner thought. I would never presume him, but I know he definitely was not on, he was not certainly not opposing the damming of Hetch Hetchy. And
this is a really hot topic, and this is something people can choose to investigate on their own, exactly the whole way that Hetch Hetchy came down with John Muir and his involvement and trying to stop it and things going on in San Francisco. It was such a politically charged,
right.
with so much to do with other things besides the water.
Right, I mean, the PG&E's role is enormous, and that was really their, has made them what they've been.
So
Kent later then wrote, co-authored the legend, at the end of his term, his three terms, co-authored the bill that created the National Park Service so that it could never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his legacy. And then he went on to be a co-founder of the Save the Redwoods League. There's a Kent park at the Kent Beach and campground in Lake Tahoe. The guy was truly a pioneer, and we owe what is the open space on Mount Tamalpais directly to William Kent, and that I played a small role in getting other people to see that. He still has family here, and his family takes care of him. He has two of his granddaughters are still alive. I met them, I've been in their homes. You know, Kent Field lives on, Kent Woodlands. He developed nothing. All his lands, which were extensive, the only two of them were subdivided after he died, Kent Woodlands and Seadrift.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the other lands are now in the public domain.
So, this is your...
That came out in 2012,
Yeah,
To Save a
so
Mountain.
I can see that there's a lot of passion with this book, and as somebody who's hiked the mountain and enjoyed the mountain and written about the mountain, it is something to be able to appreciate the fact that there's somebody responsible for allowing you to do that.
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many other heroes, but he stands at the top, and I try to tell the story of many others. The state park was expanded over the years in many, many, many transactions. The list is, they gave me a CD of it. It may have been 100 different parcels added over the years, so others have played a role.
So you've been able to tell other people's stories. You've been able to document and describe genesis of things around here, the Dipsy race. You've been able to expand. You know, you've helped people to see, to know the place we live in. To you've represented Marin County and Mount Tam and the people in it, and this is what you've been able to do with your life. For which is interesting, because when I think of you as a corporate man initially studying business at Columbia, this has been an interesting path you've been on with some twists and turns. Did you ever anticipate that this is where you'd end up when you were driving over in a broken down car from the East Coast heading west?
Well, I was, of course, certainly not the whole story. I was a fish out of water at Columbia Business School, that was for sure. I, near the end of the line, I mean, I started out with very promising economics major from Colgate and got great grades, but definitely something was going on. And by the last term, I wasn't even going to classes anymore. And they let me read books, non-business books. They're very nice professors. I don't know why they did that, but they did. And so I barely got out of there. So something was brewing early that this wasn't the right path for me.
So let's just talk a little bit before this interview ends. Let's talk a little bit about you. I mean, what the path is. You've talked about all these other people and places. How about, what would you, how do you see yourself? I know that we think of ourselves coming to an area and we make an area in a sense that we people help create a space, and but the space can also create people. And so in the ways that your life has been formed by living here in Marin County and the way that you've been influenced, I mean, how about,
Well, I must mention my family because I am at this stage in my life, and I think all, ever since it started, nothing has given me more joy even than the running highs and the calling of the Dipsy winners than my family. My wife Pam was a teacher, and then Sally and Lily, who went on to, they're both artistically gifted and went to UCLA's School of Art and are living in Los Angeles. And raising them has been just a joy and a challenge, and that's, these are my deepest values. But coming back to Tam, and I would say I'm 60, I'm going to be 67 next month. I keep saying as long as I could keep walking, I'm happy. Whenever I have any tough times, a walk or run is complete therapy. I lead hikes. I've been, this is the 21st year now I've been leading hikes for under the name Rambling with Barry. We have the same people. It used to be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Now we have two groups, Wednesday and Friday, and I love doing that, and I go out every single day. I run and I walk. I would say I miss 2, 3, 4 days a year, no more than that. No matter what the weather, actually, the rougher the weather, the better. I've seen, I like to go out early, and I pretty much see every sunrise. And it's really quiet then. And it's just, so maybe it's a selfish thing in some ways, getting so much from it. So maybe that's one reason I wanted to return so much. But that every time I show people and I see it on myself, from so much of Marin, you could turn around and not see a house, or not one at all, or one or a few in the great distance. And yet San Francisco is just a few miles away. This is absolutely incredible. And I know I'm preaching to the converted here. We know what a remarkable place. And I tell that story in To Save a Mountain. It's a miracle that this has happened. It didn't, I don't think it's happened anywhere else. Next to one
and
of the largest.
It's not just William Kent. I mean, we're talking Marinello, the Bolinas Bay, the Stinson Beach.
Right. You talked about Marty Griffin. He's played a huge role. And, when they announced this Mount Tam, there's a little anecdote. When they announced the new One Tam and the collaborative, they kicked it off at Richardson Bay, the old mansion there, the old Lyford Mansion. And one guy said, we have two great heroes here, Marty Griffin and Barry Spitz.
Wow.
And I was embarrassed beyond belief, and I told him, Marty Griffin has really done stuff. But if, you know, that was overreach, but wow.
Hey, to even be in the same sentence.
Right, I shouldn't have been, but that made me feel good. And,
so it's your way of giving back the love, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I do like sharing. I like teaching. Anybody want to hire a teacher? I'd love to do that in my last years. I'd love to share what I know, serve on a nonprofit. But I've been blessed with good health so far, and I do love getting out there. My running ever slower. I've been a coach. I've coached running for many, many, many years. Branson School, Marin Academy, where my daughters went to San Rafael High, Marin Catholic, and most recently San Domenico School, where I founded the cross country team. This is the first year I'm not coaching, but I really enjoy working with young people, and it would just be a chance for an afternoon run, which gave me another buzz, so that was pretty neat. I told you I like to run uphill. I did do the Empire State Building run up and finish very high on that. Oh, the IJ. I can't miss that. I started writing a column for the Marin Independent Journal in 1990, and it ran weekly running column for 17 years. And now, due to a lot of changes in the paper, it's very occasional. But the first column I ever wrote was about a Mill Valley couple named Willem and Els Tunzing.
Oh,
who lived on Walden.
I used to deliver Meals on Wheels with Els Tunzing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Way
up on Fern Canyon Road, up there.
Right?
Yep.
Right, way up there. They they were very involved in the running world. Their son, Case, founded the Tamalpa Runners. And I used to go up there and we'd go on runs. And
Lovely, lovely woman. I didn't know her husband, but she was great. She didn't start running till she was in her late 50s, I think.
I think that's right. She was the oldest woman to run the Dipsy. That's been eclipsed, but at that time she held a record, and she's in the Hall of Fame. She died about 10 years ago. And so that was the first column I ever wrote, and now I'm writing one this weekend because Willem, the husband, died last week. They're having a service for him in Saturday at the Mill Valley Community Center, so I'm going to write about him, and it's kind of a little circle closed. He was mid-90s, a remarkable fellow.
Your son works at the running store?
Right,
you know?
Case is a good man. So that's all I have on my list here.
Well, before we stop, let's say I have a last question I always ask.
Sure.
I think we pretty much covered a lot, but is there anything at all, a memory, a thought, a reminder, a moment in all your years of on the mountain, a moment that we haven't talked about, something you'd like to share, an embodiment of your experience on Mount Tam or your time as a runner or a hiker? You think of a final little story.
There's so many, but you've given me one and time's running out, so this comes to mind. I was researching the Dipsy book, and the traditional wisdom is that the highest point on the course is Cardiac, top of Cardiac, where the Coast View Trail now crosses the Dipsy. And to prove it, Jerry Hauke, who I mentioned is one of my heroes, great man, saved the Dipsy race from many, many people have tried to either stop the race or diminish it, but he hung in there fighting. Anyhow, he was a surveyor and he had the equipment. So we went up there on one wonderful evening, late, you know, really late, sun setting, still just a magical evening to be on the mountain. And I was what's called his, I forget the name of the, just the guy that holds the pole, really. And we measured, and it turned out that Cardiac was indeed 5 inches higher than Lone Tree. And we shook hands and we walked down, and that was a very special time, and Jerry's been a good friend ever since. So that's just one of many, many memories. I could fill your whole tape, so thank you, though.
Thank you so much for sharing your story and your time, and for recognizing the importance of historical societies and to document the history of our area and to know it too. Thank you so much for all that you've done to help us know ourselves in the county.
Thank you, Deborah, for taking your time. Thank you so much.